Blog Talk Radio.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the STEM Files on Blog Talk Radio, where we highlight the best and brightest in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. My name is Tariq Muhammad. I'm the Chairman and Chief Science Officer of Original Man Scientific. I'm joined by my co-host, Jabril.
Yes, peace and blessings, everyone. Happy to be here. Jabril Muhammad, co-host of STEM Files and Vice Chairman of Original Man Scientific. Happy to be here and can't wait to get started.
All right. Awesome, awesome. So we are joined by our guest, special guest for tonight. He's a mentor of mine for the last 2-3 years now. Been very pivotal in my personal growth and development as well as professional. He is a holistic, title. He's a holistic care physician. He's a graduate of Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee. He also works, he's based out of Houston, Texas. He's also a very proud member of the Ministry of Health and Human Services, but I'm going to let him take over because I'm kind of messing him up right now. So, Brother Keeley, the floor is yours.
Praise be to Allah. First of all, I thank you, brothers, for giving me the opportunity to share platform, to share information that can empower people's lives. I like to say, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger. I'm a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his book, How to Eat to Live, and also a student of Minister Louis Farrakhan, and how he has helped me tremendously in understanding and applying that book. And so anything that I say today of value, I believe I got from the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and I believe that it the answer to all of our problems, not only health-related, but our problems, period. And so, again, thank you all for allowing me to be a part of this program. And, you know, to all those who heard my brother call me his mentor, it's amazing because, you know, when we have an open mind, we can learn from any and everybody.
That's right.
And the brother calling me his mentor is a blessing, and it's an honor. But I've learned from him as well, and so we're probably each other's mentors, and that is just a lesson for all of us, that no matter what age a person is, no matter what part of life they're in, no matter what they study, no matter what their expertise, what their gift or talent is, we can all learn from each other and become better because of each other. So thank you again to both of you, brothers, and I look forward to the rest of the show.
Yes, sir.
Praise be to Allah. Yes, sir. And trust me, brother, the honor is all mine. Thank you for that as well. One of the major reasons we have you on tonight is because there has been a major quote-unquote flu outbreak in recent weeks. And one of the things that we are taught, especially in the teachings, is that they will do anything and anything. They will do anything within their power to cull the black population. And this recent flu outbreak has been killing a lot of our people. I've studied the flu virus over the years. I've never quite understood it until, you know, recently. I know a lot of viruses can be made man-made in the laboratory. But can you shed some light on the flu virus, the purpose of the flu virus, and just why there are outbreaks at any given moment in time? And why in particular populations?
Well, first of all, those are some excellent questions. And I want to preface my statements with this. If anybody is listening that is not part of the Nation of Islam, the reason why I started within the name of Allah is because I want to make sure that I'm trying to empty myself of any arrogance, any ego, and allow God to use me for your benefit.
Go ahead.
The second thing that I want to state is,
Yes, sir.
Hello?
I'm sorry.
Okay. The second thing I want to state is that if anybody hears anything tonight, like my brother Tariq just finished speaking on the calling of the black population, there is scientific research that we can give that proves what we are saying, and we can also give links where you can look at the statements that this government has made about what they have done, what they are doing, and what they will do to try to, the word he used, cull our population. The amazing thing about our people is that most of us know, I would say the majority of black people probably know about the Tuskegee experiment. And we're appalled that somebody would do something purposely to injure our people. And from the perspective of the people that were doing it, it was all just research. It was no different than putting something in some rats or some rabbits or some monkeys and watching, and then getting to the end of that period of watching, and then you come to some conclusions on what's going to happen when you do such and such, so-and-so. And so if you believe that a Tuskegee experiment really happened and know the ramifications around and during and before the Tuskegee experiment, then you ought to understand that that wasn't an isolated incident. There are many, many, many things that we could discuss about what has been done to black people in this country that are outrageous and completely demonic. And so I wanted to kind of preface my statements with that, because some of my statements are going to be in the same direction. So when we're talking about the flu virus, we're talking about a virus that has similar capabilities and abilities. And so I want us to, you know, if you don't really know the difference in those two words, you got to look them up, because capability and ability are two different things. And that's very relative to our conversation, because there's a reality with every virus that's called the virulence of a virus. And the virulence is the ability of a virus to cause disease in a human. And so there's some viruses out there that would be very hard to cause any disease in a human being, even with a basic immune system. So I think most people on the call probably know that you should be drinking some water. You should be eating some fruits and vegetables. You should be trying to do some exercise every once in a while. So let's just take, for instance, a person that's doing it on a minimum. Let's say a person's exercising once a week. Let's say a person eats fruits and vegetables twice a week. And let's say that a person drinks enough water maybe once or twice a week. Well, just with that minimum amount of trying to do what is good for the body, it would be relatively impossible for some viruses to even cause any disease in a human. And what does that mean? Right. That means that with a very low immune system, there are some viruses that don't have the ability, they don't have the virulence to cause disease, because your immune system would kill it very easily. So now let's look at, most of us probably remember when we have had the flu. And a flu is really just a cold, and the symptoms are a little more severe, and you add body aches. That's typically the way most people would describe what it feels like to have the flu. Man, I had the runny nose, I had the cough, I had the itchy throat, you know, I had just not feeling good, blowing my nose, headache, all these things, had a fever. And then when they say, when they have the flu, they say it was all of those same things, but I had body aches and I just felt like it was a lot worse. That's kind of the explanation that I have heard over the years of what a person feels like when they have the flu. So I started there because I want everybody to tap into what you remember, tap into what your experience is. So when we're talking about virulence, we're talking about the ability for this virus to get into the human body, and then it has to actually do something to your cells in order for it to get into your cell and start to duplicate itself. So if any of you have ever seen any of these science fiction movies where so-called aliens, like, you know, jump on top of a car and then they get in a car and then they start, you know, causing damage or killing the people that are in there, that's kind of what a virus does. a virus goes into the body, and it goes and it tries to jump onto a cell. And then it tries to find a way to get to pop an opening in the cell, to find an opening in the cell, get in the cell, and then with the nutrients and the things that are in the cell, it starts to duplicate. There is no aspect of the viruses that I have studied where a virus does anything outside of that. They're not trying to kill people. They're not trying to do any damage to any particular organs or anything like that. They just want to duplicate themselves because that's how viruses live, in living bodies. So the virulence of the flu has changed over the years. And I don't know if anybody on the call pays attention to, like, you know, YouTube videos about health as much as people that are interested in health. But if you haven't, it's been at least 20 to 25 years that I have been paying attention to information that's saying that this major pandemic. Now, another thing that everybody has to become familiar with are the differences between an epidemic and a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes,
those
sir.
Have implications that are very serious. So when something is an epidemic, there's a certain amount of people in a certain demographic. And when a pandemic, it's usually much larger. It starts to extend over to other countries, and sometimes it can go all the way around the world. Well,
right.
There have been predictions that there was going to be a worldwide flu pandemic for at least the last 20 to 25 years. And so I would just ask, why is that? Why has there been information like this? Why has there been a question out here that some major flu epidemic or flu pandemic was going to affect the whole world? That's a question that we need to ask. Why was it a suggestion that it was going to happen, and why is the flu so bad this year? Okay, I'm just going to lay those there and then just get finished with this flu, and then we'll come back to those. So now I just explained what people typically say is the flu symptoms to themselves. But in this flu that we're dealing with this year, the change and the increase in severity that it is causing with people is that some people are going into kidney failure. Some people are going into lung failure. Some
mm-hmm.
people are having nerve conditions that are coming from the flu. These are, I'm just mentioning just those three. Those are three things that weren't even considered when I was in medical school studying viruses. Wasn't even considered as part of the flu. I read something just last week about a doctor in an urgent care center who has been working in an urgent care center for 20, 25 years. And she has been diagnosing people with the flu. That was her diagnosis, her examination, her evaluation of the patient. She came to the conclusion that they have flu, and these people were being admitted in total kidney failure. That's not even something that we would even consider in a flu. And why do I believe that the flu is so bad this year, and why do I believe there's so many black people that are dying from the flu, is because the virulence of the flu that's occurring in 2018 is not the same as the virulence of the flu in 2008, nor 1998 or 1988. It is getting worse.
Right.
And when you look at the reality of the virulence of a virus, they do have the ability to improve or increase the virulence, meaning that they increase their efficiency of getting into a cell. But I have never studied, never read, nor experienced any bacteria or virus that can take itself and transform itself into something that's completely in another category. That is unheard of. So I personally believe that the flu is being changed. It's being improved, or should I say its virulence is being increased by scientists, by people.
Right.
Because in order for a virulence to change and start taking on a reality of a different type disease process, means that somebody is adding that to that. And let me give you a good example. If every single one of us that are on the call would just consider that you have children,
mm-hmm.
and let's say that you raise your children to defend themselves. You say,
right.
"Hey, you know, my son's name is Makai. Makai, if you go to school, and I'm telling y'all what I told my children, if you go to school and somebody inappropriately puts their hands on you, break their damn arm. If you go to school and somebody whoops your behind, if it was a fair fight, you take that. Ain't no going back the next day with no gun trying to kill nobody. If you want to learn how to fight, we put you in classes so that you can take certain techniques to defend yourself as well as be aggressive if you need to. And so if I raised my son like that, and that's all he talks about, you know, if I get into a fight, I'm going to do this move or I'm going to do that move or I'm going to block him like this or block him like that. And your child is, you know, through junior high, going into high school, and that's the only way they talk. And then after you put them in a certain high school, they come back home talking about, Daddy, if somebody put their hands on me, I'm going to give me a chopper and I'm going to kill them. Well, you know that when your child comes back home talking like that, somebody else got to their head. Somebody else put some information in them that didn't come from you because you don't believe in killing people. You don't believe in shooting people down. You only taught him to use his hands to defend himself or be aggressive when need be. And so that is the way the flu is acting in 2018. The flu is acting as if it has been taught something completely new, completely different, taking its virulence to a whole nother level. And it can't be science because science doesn't change like that. And if science does change like that, it takes thousands of years for science to change like that. There's no way that the flu virus could have changed from when I studied it in medical school in the 90s to now it's 2018, and it already has increased to start killing people in ways that we never considered it. That's not scientific. That's man intervention, and that's why I believe it's killing so many people. Now, why specifically black people? Because, again, I go back to that statement that my brother made in the beginning about culling the population. If people don't understand the government's programs that have been specifically against black people, then there's a lot of research that we need to share with you. Now, if you have a hard time believing that, then, you know, I can understand that if this is the first time you're hearing something like that. But I have been a part of medicine now for 22 years. And the more I learn, the more research I study, the more I see that just like there's racism in schools, just like there's racism out in the sports world, which we saw with Colin Kaepernick, just like we see most unarmed black people getting murdered and then all of these white folks that murder people, they get taken alive, just like we're seeing racism in the government with the president and all these other people, there's just as much racism in the medical community, in the medical industry. Don't believe that just because a doctor is supposed to be a person who does no harm, don't believe that those people aren't racist as well. There is just as much racism in the medical, scientific research aspect of medicine as there is in any other aspect of life. So I believe that black people are dying at a higher rate than anybody else because some of the increased virulence in this virus is being directed towards melanin. And I know that might sound crazy to some people, but how could it be that more black people are dying from the flu when we represent 13% of this population? White people are still the majority of this population. And guess what? White people are the majority of people that are getting cancer. White people are the majority of people that are going through different types of treatments for certain medical problems. So there are more of them that have a lessened or a weakened immune system than there are black people. But yet we still have the largest numbers. It's because the virulence of that flu virus is being increased and directed towards melanin. And so that means that the more melanin you have, the darker your skin, the more virulent that flu virus will be towards you and your body.
Well, virus 101. That's right.
Sir.
Jabril, did you have anything you wanted to go into?
I did have a quick question. I've been meaning to look into some more things in relation to the flu, particularly this year. Brother Kelly, do you have any metrics or in regard to, because they're talking about all these people passing and dying, but I'm curious as to the ratio or the amount that are dying that got the flu shot versus the amount that died who did not.
Did you say Brother Tariq or Brother Keeley?
I was talking to Brother Keeley, because that's one thing I haven't seen. Like, they're saying, oh, yeah, this person died and we have an epidemic. I'm curious of how many people are passing, like the percentage that are getting the flu shot and passing versus people who are not getting it or did not get it.
Yeah, that's a very excellent question, brother. First of all, let me say this. I got to go back a little bit. If anybody has ever heard of the Spanish flu.
Yes.
The Spanish flu killed millions of people. If I remember correctly, I think it was somewhere around 50 to 60 million people. So just imagine that. If 50, 60 million people in America died, that would be like a fifth of the country. That means one out of every five people that you see would die. That's a major, major, major death thing. When they did post assessment of the Spanish flu, they came to a determination that 80 to 85% of the people that had Spanish flu, now we're talking about early 1900s, had the shot for the flu. Now, you raise an excellent question, bro, because most of the major pandemics, now a pandemic is when a disease is so broad that it starts to cross continent and country lines. So, for instance, if something is very bad and it stays all in America, then that would be considered an epidemic. But if that flu or that infection would pass into Canada or pass into Mexico or pass into Canada and Mexico, it would automatically take on the characteristics of a pandemic, because they would say that if it can spread to Canada and Mexico, then it could spread to anywhere else that anybody from America would travel to. So, most of the major flus that have killed people from a pandemic perspective were studied post-mortem, meaning after the deaths of the people, and found that the majority of the people, no matter what part of the world they were in, they had some type of shot or some type of treatment for the flu. Now, that would dictate one of two thoughts. Either whatever the treatment is that people are getting for this so-called infection is weakening their immune system and making them more susceptible to it, or what they are getting that is supposed to keep them from getting the flu is giving them the flu.
So, right.
I would say that based on my research, they usually do not give any information on how many people have taken the flu shot and how many contracted the flu, because they don't want people who are thinking people to be able to put the science together.
Right.
But what I will say
is this. That makes sense. Right.
Absolutely. And what I will say is this. In my experience, again, 22 years, I'm not saying this to pump myself up. I'm not saying this for any accolades. I'm saying this so that you all know who you're talking to. You're talking to somebody who has done something long enough where even if I was dumb, stupid, and silly, I would be good at something.
Right.
Almost every person that I have ever known in my experience in medicine that got a flu shot before the flu season wound up with the flu. I have never taken a flu shot. And the last time I had the flu was 2004. So people that are sick come to me with the flu. People that are sick come and cough on me and all that kind of stuff, and I don't get sick when I'm taking care of myself correctly.
Right.
And so I have evidence just with my experience that I come to a conclusion. I don't have any scientific proof, like I say, you know, because those statistics are usually not given out until long, long, long after. But I have evidence based on my 22 years of experience that getting the flu shot is detrimental to your health. It is detrimental to your health in either way that I just finished mentioning. Now, here's one thing that we know for sure. We know the ingredients in a flu shot. And a flu shot has a lot of mercury, has a lot of aluminum, and has a lot other things such as MSG and these other additives that are so-called, what they call adjuvants. The word adjuvant is A-D-J-U-V-A-N-T. It's supposedly a substance that's put into an immunization that helps boost the immune system. And that's probably one of the biggest lies that's ever been told in medicine, because adjuvants detract from the body's ability to deal with whatever the specific thing is that it's looking for, and it also is immune disabling. These adjuvants have been studied, and most of them, if not all of them, decrease your immune system's ability to fight. And so when you get the flu shot, you probably are decreasing your body's immune system's ability, as well as sometimes you catch the flu after getting the shot, which means that there was something in that shot that gave you an infection as well. So, you know, my personal conclusions, my brother, are that more than likely, if we had the ability to do the science, if we had the ability to get accurate information, we would probably find that anywhere from 70 to 90% of the people that have the flu have probably had the flu shot. And that makes and never has made any sense to me why I would go get a flu shot so that I could wind up getting the flu.
Yes, sir. And it's a really good point you brought up about not reporting on that, because obviously you report, well, this many have passed that and that had flu shots, and then people will think, well, I'm paying X amount of money, I'm doing X, Y, and Z to get this, oh, I'm doing X, Y, and Z to kind of prevent or guard against this, and you're telling me that this many people took it and still got it and passed it, though. It doesn't make sense for a critically thinking person. You know, the logical solution, the logical thing to arrive at is that, well, I'm not going to get this. And then that's an adverse effect for the whole medical industry in regard to, like, that flu season or whatnot. So I was interested about that, but that's very interesting. So then I guess going forward with that, you know, you being a, you know, into holistic medicine and everything and studying that compound with, you know, how to eat to live, I guess, how and what is the real science behind, you know, just the general dietary law as it pertains to, you know, guarding or protection against these various viruses and medical issues?
Great question.
Yes, sir. Excellent question. The first statement I'll make is just a little bit on the past subject. You know, the government has pretty much made a mandate that physicians have to change their offices, even private practice. Most hospitals and, medical school oriented teaching facilities have already gone to medical records. But they have given private doctors the mandate as well. I don't remember what year it was, but it was a few years ago that doctors had to switch to medical records. So if we wanted, and if they wanted the public to know the information, they could get it pretty quickly, because it wouldn't take long to go into the computer at these different facilities and say, how many people were diagnosed with the flu? All we have to do is go right into their medical record, which are all joined together, and see who got the flu shot. And we could have that information, and it would take some time to do it, but it wouldn't take years to do, is my point. So, again, you know, we're talking about them that doesn't want us to have that information, because if people would know that 70 to 80 to 90% of the people that get the flu shot wind up with the flu, then the general population would stop taking the flu. And that's a major money market for these pharmaceutical companies. So I just wanted to mention that. Now, to your question, and let me make sure I understand your question, because I want to make sure I answer it. You're asking me, what is it that we can do from a holistic perspective and a perspective of how to eat to live in order to boost our immune system, in order not to get the flu and other diseases?
More or less, but really just getting into almost the science behind why the dietary law specifically is effective when it comes to warding off, like, you know, things like the flu, as well as other, you know, general diseases and things of today.
Yes, sir. Okay, so I got a long and a short answer. The short answer is because the dietary teachings of Honorable Elijah Muhammad came from God himself, and anything that you do outside of that is secondary and lesser information.
Right.
That's my short answer.
Point.
Now,
yes,
how can I get to the science behind that? Well, I want to challenge every person on this call that as we're discussing this, and maybe even when it's over, you should take some time by yourself, some quiet me time, some meditation time or quiet time, whatever you want to call it, but make sure your phone is off, make sure the TV is off, make sure the radio is off, make sure nobody interrupts you, and you should ask yourself, do I really have faith? And if I really have faith, what is my faith in? And if you come to a conclusion on what your faith in, it's, your question should be, is my faith in God? Now, why am I saying that? I'm saying that because, not to attack any particular person on the call, but there's a reality in the world today where we as people think how we were trained. We are raised a certain way. Your mama did it this way. Your daddy did it this way. They came to an agreement on how they were going to teach their children. And so we do it the way mommy and daddy taught us. And then we go out into the world once we leave our mother's nest, father's nest, and we start telling people what the right way is based on what my mom and my daddy taught me. That don't make it right. It just make it the way your mama and your daddy taught you. Now, let me give some examples. The Bible says that we should not eat catfish. We should not eat any crab, crawfish, shrimp, all this kind of stuff. But how many of you can say that you came up in a household where it was customary? Maybe not all the time, but y'all, we ate crab. We ate shrimp.
Right.
We ate foods that in the Bible it says do not eat. Now, there's one thing that I am for sure, brothers and sisters, is that when you do not follow God's recommendations, and recommendations, I mean his laws, his byways, the things that he tells us we should and should not do, if we follow that, what he says to do, we usually do really well. And when we don't follow what he says, we wind up having severe consequences.
Right.
So when I look at how to eat to live, how to eat to live is 100% in agreement with scriptures. If you go to the Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14, and you see what the Bible says about what we should eat in the waters and what we should eat and what we shouldn't eat as far as land animals, and then you go and you look into how to eat to live, that information is 100% in congruence with each other. When you go into the Quran and you see that the Quran talks about the bee and what comes from the bee is good for you, and when you look in the Quran and it talks about this substance that comes from between the blood and the feces of the cow, and then you go into how to eat to live, that information is 100% in congruence with each other. So when I, as a physician that was trained at what I would consider probably one of the best medical schools on the planet, and then I came to what's considered the best medical center on the planet, I am not an average physician. I don't believe. I'm not saying this with any arrogance, but I worked hard to be the best. And it is absolutely true that you have to be better than the white folks that you come around, because they get favor.
Right.
All black people know that in every endeavor of, in every field of endeavor, you have to be better than them. So when I came down to this medical center here in Houston, when I was a senior resident, I was a chief resident. I was voted a chief resident by my peers. So that's not something I'm putting on myself. They thought I was the best. In conjunction with another black sister, she and I were co-chief residents of our senior year. Now, why am I saying that to you all? It's not about accolades. It's not about getting any credit. It's about letting you know that I worked hard to be the best. So when you're listening to a man like me who was trained in what's considered the best in their world, I took that information and I tried to do the best that I could with it. When I first came out of residency program, one of my mantras was I was going to immunize every black child in Houston. And then information started coming my way, and I started seeing, man, there's something I got to go study about these immunizations, because I'm not seeing a whole lot of positive things. And so today, as you hear me talk, I'm 1,000% against immunizations. And that change happened mostly through how to eat to live. A physician is considered one of the most educated people on the planet in this system of America. And so when I came out of residency program and went into practicing medicine in the offices that I practiced, I felt like I studied hard enough. I felt like I got enough good experience that I could take care of black people well. And yes, my focus was on black people. It didn't make a difference who walked in the door, but my practice was going to be in a black neighborhood and trying to focus on the health disparities of black people who were in the worst condition. And so after practicing about 7 years, I was totally disenfranchised with the whole entity of medicine because I wasn't getting the results that I expected out of myself. I read How to Eat to Live. It took me, I think, about 2 or 3 days after work every day. I'd come home and just start reading. I was totally engrossed in this book. Took me about 2 or 3 days to read it. I started applying it to myself, and I started applying it to my patients, and I was watching people walk out of medical problems in sometimes a couple of months. Problems that they had for 10, 15, 20 years, I'm watching them walk right up out of it. They didn't know what I was doing, but I was applying How to Eat to Live in their lives. So I'm saying to those of you who are listening, not only can you go in the Quran and the Bible and find the congruence, but if you were to apply it to yourself, you would know that this information is coming from a superior place because of the benefit that it would give you. Now, the other thing is that I started my comments earlier with, I can go to the science and prove this to you. So there are very specific things that we need to have an adequate immune system. What are they? And I'm not saying these in any particular order. I'm just saying them in whatever order comes to my mind. Number one, sunshine.
Yes, sir.
Number two, correct food with the right nutrients. Number three, rest. Number four, exercise. Number five, correct thoughts. Now, when it comes to the nutrients that we need in the body to keep ourselves healthy and to keep our immune systems working correctly, if we were to look at a list, we have to put on there, vitamin D has to be way up at the top, your B vitamins have to be up there, your A, your K, your vitamin C, all of those are very necessary to have a very active and strong immune system. The other thing that you need is enough water. You also need nutrients. Nutrients are your minor, I'm talking about minor nutrients now, so you're talking about things like potassium and magnesium and zinc and selenium and oxygen and nitrogen and those type of things, phosphorus, okay? You need those to consider your micronutrients. Now, when you look at the necessities of the body and you look at the foods that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad put specifically in How to Eat, I'm talking about the specific foods that he mentions in How to Eat to Live, like he mentions navy beans. Navy beans are high in B vitamins. Navy beans are high in nutrients. Navy beans are one of the best foods on the planet to extract toxins out of your body.
That's right.
When it comes to raw milk, high in B vitamins, high in vitamin D, high in vitamin A, high in amino acids. Matter of fact, navy beans and raw milk have excellent sources of amino acids. What's the most beneficial thing that we get from amino acids? Improvement of brain structure, improvement of brain neurotransmitters. So navy beans and raw milk are good for your brain. Just a little sidebar. But when you look at the vegetables that he suggested to us, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, these foods are very high in B vitamins. He said all fruits are good for you. And then he also said that we must eat the best of foods. So understand that in 2018, the best of foods is not one that's seedless. Why would God make a grape with a seed, a watermelon with seeds, and then you go to the store and you buy seedless grapes and seedless watermelons? Why did you make that decision?
Go ahead.
Right.
If you look at fruits as a entity, They are very, most of them are very high in vitamin C. Most of them are very high in your B vitamins. All of them have high levels of nutrients, those micronutrients I was talking about earlier. And fruit is, as a class of foods, fruit is the best food on the planet when you're trying to decrease oxidation. When you're trying to do antioxidants, you should go to fruit.
Wow, yes, sir.
Now, I want to make something very clear to everybody that's listening that hasn't gotten it yet. I haven't said nothing about no doggone supplement. I ain't say nothing about going to GNC. I ain't say nothing about going to the vitamin shop. I ain't say nothing about going to no place, no online store, nothing, and buying no supplements or no vitamins out of no canister. You can never have something from man that's going to outdo what God gave you. If you want to be in the best of health, you have to go to foods, because God put those foods on this planet in the perfect way for your body to break it down and extract it. You have no idea what you're getting from something that you're swallowing with a gelatin capsule or some food-based vitamin, and they tell you what foods these vitamins came from, but then they'll turn around and tell you that food doesn't have any nutrients. Well, hell, if the food don't have no nutrients, how in the hell did you get it in a doggone canister and a pill for me to take?
You can't get that over on nobody
that's a thinking man or a thinking woman. And then if you take any piece of fruit or any vegetable off the source of its life, meaning you take it off the plant, you pluck it out of the ground, it starts to die immediately. It's going to be rotten in a few days. How can you take a food, make it into a vitamin pill, and then put it in a bottle? You don't have any idea when it was first taken and harvested. You have no idea when it was made into the pill. You have no idea how long it took to get out of that facility that they made it in and then shipped it wherever you live. How could it last that long when real food spoils? So again, we're talking about how to eat to live, and we're talking about why how to eat to live will give you the ability to not get the flu or any other diseases. What proof do you have of that? You're talking to somebody who comes from a family full of diabetes, full of high blood pressure, full of strokes, full of heart attacks, full of all kinds of diseases. And as I'm speaking to you right now, I'm 50, and I have no medical problems, no problems doing anything physically that I decide in my mind that I'm going to do. During the cold time of the year, I don't exercise that much, but during the warm time of year, I exercise for 2 hours in the middle of the day sometimes. So these are things that we have to understand. How to Eat to Live is telling you how to put your diet back into the way that God wants us to eat. And so if you eat the way God wants you to eat, there are no consequences. But when you go to fast food restaurants and regular restaurants and you go and eat all this stuff that's called junk food, I don't understand how we can put junk and food in the same sentence.
Right.
Most of what most people are eating is not food. It's something that man makes that fills your stomach. But when it comes to those nutrients and those vitamins that I just finished talking about, they are void of that, and that's why you get sick, and that's why your body deteriorates, and that's why you don't have any physical comfort, because your body is not being taken care of in the way that it should be.
Brother Keith, can you repeat your age one more time?
50 years young.
So just for the record, for all those who are listening, Brother Keeley is not 50, he's 30. Because every time I see the brother, it's almost like, every time I see him, it's almost like he's in my age group. Just for the record, y'all. So whenever, if y'all were to ever meet Brother Keeley, that age will not correspond to what he looks like. So he is a living proof of how Eat to Live works and what it can do for you and how it can change your life for the better. So I commend you for that, brother.
Praise be to Allah. It's all because of How to Eat to Live. I can't take any credit for it.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's awesome. You know, I am, you know, I think a lot about just How to Eat to Live, and particularly eating of one meal a day. And just, you know, because all food has some level of toxicity to even the best of foods. And it's just the letting your body recuperate and filter, you know, that whether it's a large or small amount, it does your body good. And it's funny because even when, like, you know, it might be a day I'm running around or whatever and I didn't stick to eat one meal a day as I normally do or whatnot, I just noticed, and I think to myself, I'm like, man, like, it's people that do this every day. And I was like, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, it's tiring to eat three meals a day every single day. And I'm just thinking, like, you know, you eat your breakfast, and then not 3 hours later, you're
going
to eat lunch.
Right.
And then a few hours later, you're going to eat dinner. You're going to do that same thing the day after that. And I was just like, man, so it just – and sometimes I think it makes so much sense that eating one meal a day. But it's just like, you know, I guess even speaking to, if you could, you know, just the thought process. Like when I tell people sometimes I eat one meal, they're like, oh, my God, one meal a day? You'd have thought I told them that I shoot myself in the foot once every day. Like, so – just, I guess, speaking to that a little bit, like the reaction. Why is it such a visceral reaction when it comes to the average person when learning that someone eats one meal a day? That, oh my God, you can't get that. You're not going to get the nutrients. You got to eat, and your body should be digesting something at all times. You know, can you just speak mentality, and then how, and like how, like kind of where that stems from, and then how to really debunk that? Not so much how, but just debunking that.
Yes, sir. Well, the first thing that I have to do is I have to just challenge everyone that's listening to understand that if I just finish saying something that you either don't understand or have never heard before, and you have to ask yourself, does what he said make sense? And what that I said makes sense when it comes to faith and believing in God? Because I said those things for very specific reasons. And then from that, let's go into three meals a day. Why do you believe three meals a day is good? You've never seen a scientific study that said three meals a day were good. You've never seen a research project that said three meals a day is how you should eat in order to get those nutrients and vitamins that I just finished mentioning. You've never seen it. You know why I know you haven't seen it? Because it's never been done. The whole premise of three meals a day came from the United States Agriculture Department and the food corporations. They decided that America needed to eat three meals a day because of how much money they wanted to make. So when you come to me as a thinking man and you say, I need three meals a day, I will debunk that immediately like this. Okay, well, what did you have for breakfast? Oh, well, I had some eggs and some turkey sausage and some toast. Okay, how long does that take to digest? Well, I have no idea. I know you don't have any idea. That's why I asked you that. But the turkey is going to take probably somewhere around 6 to 8 hours to digest. The egg is probably going to take about 5 hours to digest, and the bread maybe a couple of hours. So when you put food in your stomach and that food all starts to get churned together, the digestion process takes as long as the longest food takes to digest. So if you ate turkey bacon for breakfast and it was 8 o'clock when you ate that, you won't be finished digesting that till the earliest 2 p.m. So when you eat your chicken sandwich at 12 o'clock, you haven't even finished digesting your breakfast.
Go ahead.
And when you eat a meal and the other meal has not been finished digesting, you push that meal out of the stomach into the intestines, which has a small ability to digest, but nowhere near like the stomach. So you're literally going to start defecating your nutrients into the toilet because you never completely digested it. And so you eat a chicken sandwich for lunch. It's 12 o'clock. And you get home at 6 o'clock ready to eat dinner, and your chicken sandwich is going to take 8 hours to digest. So you're doing the same thing over and over and over again every day, and you're doodling most of your nutrients in the toilet. So you're paying money for this food if you're really eating food. I just finished explaining that. If you're eating junk, it don't make a difference one way or the other. But if you're eating quality food and you're eating three meals a day or four meals a day or five meals a day or like some of these people, seven meals a day, you never finish digesting anything. So the likelihood that you're getting the proper nutrients from the food that you're putting in your body is totally impossible, first of all. The second thing that I would ask any and every single one of you is to look. You ain't got to ask them no questions. You ain't got to have no long conversation. Do your own research project. go find everybody where you work or where you go to school or where you typically hang out with other people. Ask people that are eating 5 or 6 meals a day. Just ask them, hey, how many meals a day do you eat? Oh, I eat 5 meals a day. Well, why do you eat 5 meals a day? Well, I think that's the healthiest thing for your body, yada, yada, whatever their expectation is. And just sit back and look at them. Ask them what their age is and compare their age to other people their same age. I promise you, people that eat the most meals age the fastest. People that eat multiple meals, like 4 and 5 and 6 meals a day, they look horrible. They're 20 looking like they're 8,000. So there's a lot of evidence that you as a person can start to logically do to evaluate the information that you're getting. Now, I would agree with my brother 1,000%. I am working on one meal every other day. And this May will be my 3rd year working on that. I fail sometimes, and I achieve well sometimes. I'm working to master this as I believe I was trying to master one meal every other day. So recently I went to the org and was doing some auditing. And, of course, in the auditing process, they said that my dietary habits were incongruent with auditing. So, you know, trying to do things to make myself better. I'm trying to self-improve. I submit it to their process outside of the pills. Now, I ain't taking no pills. I eat food that gives me vitamin B1, which would be navy beans, which would be raw milk, which would be asparagus, which would be broccoli, which would be cauliflower. I eat plenty of that every day, sunflower seeds. I ate the foods that would give me vitamin B1 every day. I'm not going to take no tablets. I don't believe in tablets. I don't believe there's anything in that tablet that can do me any good, especially in comparison to the food. But the point that I'm getting to is that, just like you, brother, I had to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner while I was doing this auditing process. And I felt horrible. After about 2 or 3 days, I told my wife, I'm sick of eating.
Right.
I'm really sick of eating. I mean, I know why I'm doing it. I have a logical thought process on why I'm doing it, but I am sick of eating. I hadn't eaten that much food in years.
Right.
So all I'm saying, people, is that everything on the planet Earth is relative.
Right.
If Brother Jabril is standing on the left side of Brother Tariq and I'm standing on the right side, hell, we're going to see something different. Hey, Brother Tariq got a mole on his cheek. Nah, I ain't see no mole. Man, you didn't see no damn mole. No, you didn't see that he didn't have no mole. Now, you see the two of us arguing about the fact that Brother Tariq got a mole on his face, and all you got to do is just walk around in front of him and be like, okay, the mole's on his left cheek, and the brother on the other side just couldn't see it. So all I'm saying is that if you eat multiple meals, of course that's what you think is right. But you don't know that it's right because of any scientific research that you did. You know that it's right because your parents trained you in that thought process, just like mine trained me, that I need to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Now, I personally have more energy, more endurance, and more mental clarity when I switch from 5 meals a day, which I was doing when I first read How to Eat to Live, to 1 meal a day. My energy level went up, my endurance went up, my clarity went up, my everything from a physical perspective and a mental perspective got better. So what is that? That's my personal experiment. And then after doing How to Eat to Live for about 4 or 5 months, I went all at it, 1,000%, jumped in the deep end, and then I fell back and went back to eating about probably somewhere around 2 or 3 meals a day and immediately felt the effects.
Wow.
So what am I saying? I'm saying to every single one of you who is listening, who has heard what I say, if it makes any sense to you, any common sense, well, now your responsibility is to go and experiment with yourself. Don't get off the call and say, oh, them niggas crazy. They talk about eating 1 meal a day, and I eat 5 meals a day. This dude was on the call talking about eating 1 meal every other day. He must be crazy. There ain't no way. Yeah. There's no way if you stay in the same thinking.
Right.
But if you have any type of respect for the brothers that have this call, which I'm sure most of you do, then the first thing you have to do, or if some of you are on the call who know me and never heard this before, you got to say, well, hey, what have you heard that I've given as medical information that was a lie? What have you heard of medical information that I've ever given that doesn't give you good results. So this is not the type of information, if it's new to you, that you should reject at face value. This is the type of information that you should say, well, let me go see what this person is talking about. So if you do eat a breakfast and it has some meat in it, maybe you ought to consider that day skipping lunch.
Right.
Eat that breakfast and then don't eat anything until dinner. See how your body responds. Does your body feel a little lighter? Do you feel a little less sleepy in the afternoon, like most of y'all do after you finish eating that lunch? You fall asleep at your table or whatever you do at work. You've gotten a hard time functioning because you're so with that itis.
Right.
These things. Try eating instead of 3 meals a day, go to 2 meals a day. What is your energy level like? What is your endurance like? What is your mental clarity like? And then if your mental clarity, endurance, and your physical alertness improves, then what do you think would happen if you went from 2 meals to 1 meal? And see, when you start hearing new information and you start experimenting with it, if you start trying to figure out, well, what are these people saying? Let me go see what they're talking about, since you never got any explanation on why 3 meals a day was good. You've never gotten any explanation on why 5 meals a day was good. So I'm trying to give you the explanation behind why 1 meal a day is good or 1 meal every other day is good. You should try to take this information and experiment with yourself and see what gives you the best results. And I promise you, if anybody that goes from multiple meals a day to 1 meal a day and do it for a little while, you're not necessarily going to feel good the first day. You might not necessarily feel good the first couple of days. But if you stick with it for a week or 2 weeks, if any of you say that you got worse because you ate less meals, I'll give you $1,000 out of Brother Jabril and Brother Tariq's pocket.
Yes, sir.
All right, man. $1,000 each,
wow.
or like $500 apiece?
Hey, ain't nobody coming back with that, man. You gotta worry about it.
Yes, sir.
Praise be to Allah. Yes,
wow.
sir. Wow. Well, we have we have an hour left in the show, so I kind of wanted to go a little further into how you got started into medicine and kind of work our way back up to the topic of the flu. Just coming from your training and just how you found a love for medicine and just, you know, being able to take care of your people. When did it all start? Like, did it start in high school? Did it start in college? How did you get involved in medicine?
Wow. About to take me back right there. I actually do not recall the situation very vaguely, and only when my mother reminded me.
Oh,
wow. I was sitting next to her one day. My parents were not big TV promoters, so we didn't watch a lot of television. But this evening, I was sitting with my mother watching National Geographic Channel.
Mm-hmm.
There was a program on about a heart surgeon. She said I was about 4 or 5 years old, and I turned to her and pointed to the TV and said, that's what I want to do. And so as far back as I can remember, bro, I wanted to be a physician. My father was a dentist, and by the time I was in the 6th grade, he had changed our garage into his dental office.
Wow.
And so I used to assist him sometimes. But I think one of the biggest effects that he ever had on my life, you know, sometimes we would be out in the front yard playing, or we'd be out in the front yard picking weeds, you know, doing whatever we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see people come to the house in total and complete pain, teeth hurting so bad they could barely walk, holding their face, crying, whatever the case may be. Go in my dad's office, a couple hours later, come out with smiles on their faces.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a little boy saying, that's the way I want to affect people. I want to take care of people
mm-hmm.
like that.
Right,
and I didn't
right.
want to be a dentist. You know what I mean? I just knew that I wanted to have that type of effect on people. So, you know, I started mostly just kind of interacting with my own immediate family, my aunts and uncles and grandparents. Like most black families, a lot of them drank, a lot of them smoked. And I would walk around family gatherings with my little anatomy book and talking to my aunts about what smoking was going to do, talking to some of my people about what drinking was going to do to them eventually, showing them the body parts that they were going to be affecting. I mean, I'm like 6, 7, 8, 9 years old doing this kind of stuff. And so I believe that those type of experiences were ordained. I don't believe I had a choice. I don't believe I made the choice. I believe Allah gave me that inclination, that gift, that talent. And I believe that my experience as a child being raised in a house where my father was in the Nation of Islam, my mother was in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, but we were always having some type of community meeting at our house. I remember as a little boy there being Black Panther meetings at our house, National Black United Front meetings, Nation of Islam meetings, just black people always in our house talking about how we were going to change the community. So all of these things molded me to love my people. And as I went into college and into medical school, I went to college at Prairie U A&M University down here near Houston, and then medical school, Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee. And Meharry Medical College has a mantra that we take care of the indigent. So the people that are not being taken care of well, the people who are being ignored, the people who have the worst health are usually the ones that the mainstream medicine ignores, like in every other aspect of life. Right. And so I dedicated myself, I believe, at a very young age to taking care of black people. And if there's anybody that's on this call that is not a black person, that doesn't mean anything against you. That just means that black people are typically not cared for by the medical establishment. And as I said earlier, I have white patients, I have Mexican patients, I have Asian patients who love me, because when they walk through the door, I'm not going to treat you different because you're a different race or a different ethnicity. But my focus as a general idea is to help improve black people, because we don't have anybody helping us. And so when I came, when I went to Meharry, it was probably one of the greatest blessings, because I wanted my education to be free of racism so I could just concentrate on learning as much as I could. And the amazing thing about medical school that I'm sure none of you know, if unless you're a physician, is that there are many people in medical school that are generational doctors. So their parents were doctors, had money. Some people have parents that have high influence, you know, political offices, whatever the case may be. And I watched people pay their way through medical school. I saw people paying teachers for tests. I saw people having sex with teachers for grades. I saw people that had enough money to pay for national exam answers and then come and start charging everybody in the school to get the answers. Now, just being honest with you, that was very enticing to me because I wanted to finish. I wanted to graduate. I didn't want to not make it. It was very, very difficult from a perspective of a diligence and a dedication to something that you have to work on now and you don't get the benefits until later. But I refused to fall into that trap of cheating. I refused to fall into that trap of paying my way for the answers, because I knew there was going to come a day. And I used to tell people this in medical school. There's going to come a day when I'm sitting in front of a patient and I want to be able to explain things down to the things that they can't even see so that they can understand what is going on with them so that I can empower people to improve their own health. That was a thought of mine when I went into medical school. So I couldn't be a cheater. I couldn't be a person that was trying to find the easy way out. I needed to work my behind off so that I could sit today and have a conversation with you all and whoever's listening and give you information in a way that you can understand it. Not sitting here and talking with all these highfalutin medical terms to make you think I'm important, but you don't understand nothing when I get off the call. That's foolish to me. That's not the type of physician I wanted to be. And so, you know, I left Meharry Medical College and came down here to University of Texas at Houston, supposedly number one medical center in the whole world. And I got real confident real quick in that I could take care of people and I could take care of them effectively, and it was for the right reason, because money was never my motivation. Prestige was never my motivation. For a person to walk into my office and to feel horrible, look horrible, not know what they need to do, when they take their medications, they feel bad. When they don't take their medications, they feel bad. And you interact with me, and then another week, another month, another 6 months, another year, and you're a totally different person. You're much more healthy. You feel better. That's why I wanted to practice medicine. And so when I came down here, I was working in LBJ Hospital, which is a poor hospital in the black neighborhood. I worked in Acres Home Clinic, which was a poor clinic in a poor neighborhood, because I wanted to be around people that needed me, because I knew why God gave me my gift at that point in my life. The only problem at that time in my life was that I took the medical information and knowledge that I received from Meharry Medical College and University of Texas at Houston hook, line, and sinker. And I knew that the information that I got was the best, and couldn't nobody help people like I could. So I rejected acupuncture, even though I had good experiences with acupuncture as a young boy. I rejected people coming and telling me that herbs were better than medications. I rejected people that wanted to talk to me about alternative therapies, because what I learned in medical school and in this medical center, it can't be touched. This is the best thing on the planet. That was my attitude. And by the time I had been practicing medicine approximately 5 to 7 years, that attitude started to change, because I was only being successful as far as improving my patients on chronic diseases at about 35%. I had a computer system that would track people that I was seeing for the whole year and how many got on less blood pressure medicines, how many of my diabetic patients are on less diabetic medicines. My computer system could do that type of tracking. I was successful at doing that about 34 to 35%. The national average at that time was 15. So I was doing 20% better than the national average, and I was totally unsatisfied. And that's about the approximate time that I started reading How to Eat to Live. And when I started seeing the results that I was getting out of How to Eat to Live, God took me in a direction that I'll never be able to go backwards in. The defining change of my life was in 2009, when my cousin, one of my closest cousins, was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer, for the third time. And she called me and she said, "Akili, I'm going to fight this, but I don't want to do chemotherapy and radiation. I want you to put a healthy program together for me, and I'm going to follow it, and I'm going to beat it." And I told her, "I'll do the best I can. I think you're making the right decision, because chemotherapy and radiation, I know, is not the right direction to go." And so, to make a long story short, she did not make it long, because my family didn't support the program and didn't support her like I felt they should have. But that was a defining moment in my life. 2009, March is when I drove to California to her funeral. I came back to Texas 2 weeks later in April, opened my office, saw 17 patients, closed my practice, and I have not prescribed. I have not been a prescribing physician since that day. How Deep to Live has changed my life drastically. And so, that's where I am now. I can't go back to what I know is not effective, and I got to try to push towards what God says and what God has planned for these bodies. And no matter how long it takes, no matter how much the struggle, that's what my life journey is now.
Right. Wow. So just the way you use How Deep to Live in your in the healing process, and when it comes to your patients, how would you encourage other physicians to do the same in their practice?
Wow, amazing question. Let me first say that it takes faith. I didn't join the Nation of Islam for any emotional, ethereal reasons. I joined the Nation of Islam because of how Hadi to Live transformed my life from a career perspective. And then I started looking at the other aspects of it, and I was like, wow. Well, that's a difficult question, bro, because, you know, there are a lot of physicians in the Nation of Islam. And a lot of times we have conversations, and when some physicians hear what I say, their comments prove to me that they don't believe what I'm saying. I'm not saying that to put anybody down. I'm not saying that to shed any negative light on anybody. I'm saying that what happened to me, I think, was my gift. What happened to me was my experience that I was supposed to go through. And it takes a level of confidence mixed with faith that what this man, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, wrote in this book has value. And if I can go to school, 4 years of college, 5 years of medical school, 3 years of residency program, that's how many years it took me to finish and start practicing. And a two-part book series, first book with 116 pages, second book with 191 pages, can totally outperform all those years of study, all those years of so-called gaining knowledge. That's a pretty profound idea.
Yes, yes it is.
And so that's how it affected me. That's how I came to the conclusion that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in writing How to Eat to Live, put at the top from God in person. When I first started reading that book, I was like, man, I don't have any idea what the hell that means, but it shows some good stuff inside. But when the stuff inside started making me think about what's on the cover, that's when I came to the conclusion, man, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad can show me how to practice medicine better, and I'm so-called one of the most educated people in this country. That's a profound idea that a man that didn't finish fourth grade can teach me so much, can totally change the way I practice medicine, and helped me be much more effective than I ever was when I was following what I learned in these institutions. That was a profound idea, and that's when I came to the conclusion of what God in person means, what God is a man, because I did not understand that. What I have friends that were in the Nation, and when they would come around me and say things like God is a man, when they would leave, I was like, man, these niggas is crazy. I mean, really crazy. What the hell are they talking about? God is a man. But when I sat down and thought about the profound idea that this man that didn't finish the fourth grade taught me how to be a better physician, I said, man, that man that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad met with was something special, was something superior, and now I see. And that's what did it for me. And so the only thing that I believe is going to do that for other physicians is that they would have to be ready to make the type of sacrifices that I made, because I'm not making as much money as I used to make when I was practicing medicine in that world. But I can't go back and start prescribing things and doing things for money, and I know I'm hurting people. I can't do that.
Right.
It takes some boldness. It takes some confidence and some faith that when you take those people off of those medications and you tell these people, hey, look, I want you to have confidence in this bean soup. I want you to have some confidence in this broccoli, in this cauliflower, that this is going to take care of you. In a world that has been made, trained, and conditioned, that if something hurts, take a pill. My head hurts, take a pill. My ankle hurts, take a pill. I got high blood pressure, take a pill. We, if we're honest with ourselves, have been conditioned to go see a doctor and get something to take, rather than when you see something happen in your body, you go do something. And so it was a very difficult transition, I am absolutely ecstatic that Allah took me in the direction that he did. It's been a tough road, but the benefits are enormous. And I believe that the best way that I can help other physicians make that transition and join me on this journey is to keep doing what I'm doing and keep trying to help people find their healing journey. I'm not a healer. I don't think any human is a healer. I think people that call themselves healers are very arrogant because none of us made the cells that are in a human body. None of us made the systems that are in a human body. None of us made the organs that are in a human body. None of us made the vitamins, nor the nutrients, nor the substances that are in the plants to heal our body. God made all of that. So you might be a conduit of information. I am a conduit of information. But the healing comes from you, your determination, and your dedication to a program that will get you where you need to be. So the Creator is the healer, and each of us can heal ourselves with doing the right thing. But those of us who want to help in that process have to be willing to have that contrast happen within ourselves. I came to the conclusion that every time I write a prescription, I have to sit and tell these people about what possibly could go wrong first. That just got to a place to me where it just didn't make any sense why I'm going to write this person a pill and then have to sit down and have a conversation with them about what could potentially go wrong, and that conversation was longer than what the pill is going to do.
Right.
And honestly, I mean, we really have to be honest. I'm going to ask this question, I'm going to end, and I want you all to be honest with yourself. How many of you, take my time and ask it so you can think through it, how many of you can honestly say to yourself, I'm whatever age I am, I remember I injured my knee 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 5 years ago. But I'm going to have confidence in this bean soup and this raw milk and these vegetables and this fruit to heal my knee. I have been told that I have diabetes by this doctor I saw last week. When I go into How to Eat to Live, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad mentions in Book 2, take no medicines for high blood sugar. Change the way you eat. Eat one meal a day, and if you catch it in time, you can rid your body of this disease. How many of us would go into How to Eat to Live and read the 6 statements that he makes in Book 1 about diabetes and then the few statements that he makes in Book 2 about diabetes and then stand on that and work on that and get rid of diabetes? How many of us would have that type of faith and confidence in that book? And see, that takes some faith. That takes some confidence. That takes some sacrifice to have somebody come to you. I'm telling you what has happened within the last 5 months. Somebody called me, just got released from the hospital. Sugars were in the 600s. This is a believer. Call me and ask me what I think they should do. These people want to give me this prescription and that prescription and this prescription. My first question was, who do you believe in? What you mean? What you mean what I mean? Who do you believe in? I believe in Master Farah Muhammad. And who does he teach? He tells Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Have you read How to Eat to Live lately? No, sir. Well, I need you to go to Book 1 and read these 6 pages that he mentions diabetes, and then you call me back. He called me back. I said, are there any questions? He said, yeah, I got questions, but I understand your point. And then I pointed him to Book 2 where Donald Black Muhammad said, do not take any medication. I said, now, do you understand where I'm coming from? He said, yes, sir. I said, do you still want me to give you advice? Yes, sir. Okay, well, all we got to do is follow what Donald Black Muhammad said. You got to increase your proteinaceous foods. You got to get rid of these certain foods. You got to make sure you step up your activity. I don't want you to go from a person who does nothing to trying to work out. Now you die from a damn heart attack. But when you go to Walmart, why are you parking up there next to the damn door? Park at the end of the parking lot and take your time and walk. You're increasing the activity of your life. If you work on the second floor or the third floor, why are you taking an elevator? Walk up the steps and down the steps every day. When you go to the grocery store, don't park next to the door. Park at the end of the parking lot. Increase the activity of your life. Activity burns sugar. Activity helps balance out diabetes. And to date, that brother has not taken a medicine. His diabetes is doing wonderful, and he's had no problems since he got out the hospital. And so that doesn't come just off the rip. This has been almost 12, 13 years now that I've been experimenting, not in a way to cause any problems, but experimenting with people who trust me with how to eat to live, and I'm watching diseases get taken out left and right. But that's a very serious and profound idea for you to consider within yourself. Would you have that type of confidence to go to food to solve your problems versus what man makes? And that's why I keep talking about God and faith, because food, I'm talking about natural food, not seedless stuff and not man-made stuff, but food, real food that comes from the ground, whole foods that come from sources that we're supposed to eat from. If you take that, which is what God made for your body, versus an insulin shot or a blood pressure pill or a cholesterol pill or a vitamin or whatever you're taking, how is there any comparison when you look at it from a perspective of faith?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Brother Jabril, you still there? Jabril, you still with us? Okay. Jabril, you still there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, cool.
Yes,
cool.
Sir.
You got quiet for a minute. You had any questions for
the
brother?
Yes, sir. Go ahead. I'm just continuing. I'm hanging on to what he was saying. But you go ahead. I'm just going on with what you were going on. So we can continue on with that.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So we're actually coming up on the conclusion of the show, and I just want to first say thank you, Brother Keeley, for everything that you shared with us and the wisdom, especially as it pertains to the flu, how it's affecting the human population, and just the overall mechanism behind it. And one of the things that we ask our guests going towards the end of the show is, what does science mean to you? If you were to speak, if you were to come in contact with a young person and ask you, Dr. Keeley, what is science to you and why is it so important to you? What would you tell them?
The first thing I would tell them is, that's an excellent question. The second thing that I would say is, I personally believe that science is the best way, the most amazing way, and most profound way that you can prove who God is. And let me give an example. I was having a conversation with my son today, who is, you know, I'm divorced from his mother, so he stays with his mother. He comes to me from time to time. But he was telling me that there was no way he believed that God is a man, that he believed God is a spirit, and that God can take any form that he wants to. He could be a man, he could be a burning bush, or he could be whatever. And I said, okay, I understand where you're coming from. I said, you know, but there's a reality that you have to take everything that you believe and compare it to. Otherwise, I don't really see that people truly believe something that they can't prove. You say you believe it, but your actions prove something totally different. And so
right,
I use
right.
the example that you can't see gravity. Can you? No, I can't see gravity.
Nope.
I said, yeah, but you take your behind over there in that building over there that's 10 stories high, and you say, because I don't see no gravity, I don't believe it exists. And if you jump off that building, the likelihood is you're not going to live past that experience.
Right.
You're not going to know that. You're going to know there was gravity on your way down, but you're probably not going to live. Now, let's say that a person decides to do that on a one-story building. When you land on that ground, you're going to get up with a different reality of what gravity is. And so there's some things that we can't see, and there's some things that we have to just have faith in. But ultimately, there's so many things that we can prove with science there is a God and that his information will give you superior results. And I'll go back to what I mentioned earlier. I come from a family, I'm talking about on my father's side now, they are from New Orleans. And prior to Katrina, New Orleans had a population of about 580,000 people. So New Orleans was considered a major city in America because of its tourist attractions, because of its popularity. But as far as numbers, it's nowhere near the top. Houston has like 5 million people. Los Angeles got 8 million. New York got 10 million. So in comparison, you know, if people start talking about major cities, they'll probably mention New Orleans amongst other cities, but from a population perspective, nowhere near it. Out of 586,000 people, when you look at the disease processes per capita, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart attacks, stroke, I mean cancer, New Orleans had the highest rate of disease diagnosis than any place on the planet Earth. This was prior to Katrina. 586,000 people, that much disease. And if you look at their lifestyle, the foods that they eat, the majority of the New Orleans diet is directly in contradiction to the teachings of God, no matter where your source. So to me, that's scientific proof that when you go against God, you got major consequences. And when we look at the community overall in the black community, and I want everybody to listen to understand, if you black, brown, or red, I consider you black. When you look at the diseases in the black community, we are suffering because we're not following the instructions that come from God. We say we believe, but we're not proving it with our actions. And, you know, my last statement will be this. Whether you believe that the Nation of Islam is legitimate or not, and if you believe or don't believe that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad met with God, is irrelevant to the consequences of God. You can go in the Bible, you can go in the Quran, and you can look at every story. When God chose a person, he chose Moses and Aaron, he chose Noah, he chose Lot. He chose Ad, through all these different people that you have in these scriptures. And any time the people did not listen to the person that said, God sent me, he destroyed them. And if you look at how horrible our communities are when it comes to a health perspective, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, strokes, heart attacks, cancer. These diseases used to be very low in the black community, and now we're going towards the top, and we're still only 13-15% of the population. If you look at Native Americans, diabetes through the roof. If you look at Mexican population, diabetes through the roof. You cannot say that in general our condition is not because of the fact that we are rejecting the type of information that can save our life.
Yes, sir.
Wow. Jabril, do you remember when we said we were going to do like a compilation of what all of our guests thought of how science is to them, and we were going to make like a series of recordings for that?
Yes, sir.
So this Brother Keeley's version of what science means to him, I think that should go towards the ending, because his was pretty much the best out of everyone else's viewpoint, or just not so much the best, but the most thought out and explained. And you kind of went in depth, you went into the teachings a little bit more when it came to your viewpoint on science. So that was very excellent.
Yes, sir.
Praise be to Allah. Brother, do you have anything real quick?
You know, beloved, I've just been taking it all in, you know, the vigor that brother speaks with. You know, regardless of what you say, you can make or have people believe you with the vigor and the level of determination that you speak with. And, you know, experience that what brother says to be true. But, you know, I think a lot of times when it comes to what we know to be good, we have to be found to step out on faith and really be not simply a promoter, but one who just exudes faith in that which we believe in personally, particularly when we talk to others about it. And I think that's what Brother Achille really brought to the table, in addition to the sheer content behind what he gave. So I'm just thankful for Brother to take his time out to speak with us and speak to our listeners and really give really a testimony, you know, above everything of just relating to the flu and how to live and just proper health in general. So I definitely thank you, brother.
Well, thank you, brother. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the platform. And inshallah, I was used to help empower somebody, even if it was just to make a person think through some things. And again, thank you for the compliments. And I got to just re-admit that all praise is due to Allah.
Yes, sir.
That's right.
Giving us Donald Elijah Muhammad. And my last statement to anybody and everybody that is listening that may not be a part of the Nation of Islam, I would say if you heard my testimony and you think that it sounds amazing, study. You know, ask us, ask me, ask whoever, what we would suggest you study for any particular ideology that you're looking for, or maybe a specific subject matter, and then go put it to the test. You know, it's time in 2018 for us to start evaluating what information source we are getting and what results is it getting us to acquire. And if you have any confidence in me and what I have said tonight, then I would suggest that you go try to get some of those results for yourself, because as a community, we have to study what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has given to us as a body of knowledge. Because my conclusion is that the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as they come through Minister Louis Farrakhan are the answers to every single solitary problem we have as a people, as a community, and as a country. They would all be solved.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Yes, sir. Brother Keely, how can people contact you if they want to learn more about what you do and your services?
Yes, sir. Well, if anybody is trying to contact me for an individual consultation, you got some medical issues you want some help with, you want some direction or explanation with, the telephone number is 832-429-4576. That's 832-429-4576. The other two ways that you can get more information about me are the three ways, and or just kind of follow what things that I'm doing to try to help empower people is, my YouTube channel is The Ultimate Wellness Group. My Facebook page is The Ultimate Wellness Group. And my Instagram page is The Ultimate Wellness Group. Those are the three places where I try to, deliver some type of message every week. I do a Facebook Live every Tuesday from 4 to 5 Central Time. I try to do a question of the week on my Instagram page, and on my YouTube I try to put something on there every week or every couple of weeks. So those are the places that you can go and kind of follow me on social media. And then my website is theultimatewellnessgroup.com. You can go there and get to all my social media, but that's just kind of some information on my perspective and some information on a little bit of information you can read. And that's really all you have to do is just remember the Ultimate Wellness Group, and anywhere you go, any of those four places, my website, Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube, and I'll be on there trying to help empower you. So So reach out, follow, and let's interact.
Yes, sir.
Praise be to Allah. But Jabril, you had anything before we go?
Well, you know, sir, you know, this has just been another cracking open of the STEM files, you know, where we bring you the best and the brightest, you know, for all those who are listening, all those who continue to listen, continue to support. You know, thank you so much. You know, us at OMS are really trying to continue to bring not only content, but to take the content that we give and build that into, you know, products that we give, physical things that we give to really advance our community one day at a time in the scientific realm, which we know to be linked to limitless progress of our community and really the world. So, you know, just thank you so much. Brother Tariq, what are some things that our listeners and other people that support us can look forward to going forward?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. So our STEM Files will resume its next episode on March 3rd. Before we get into that, I want to encourage everyone to go see the Black Panther movie. It's been getting a lot of great acclaim. It has a lot to do with science and technology, so we will be bringing it up in the show in the future as we, you know, try and make an attempt to create a world similar to Wakanda. So that's going to be another topic of the show. But our next guest is Sister Anika Watson out of New York City. She teaches chemistry and biology to children with quote-unquote special needs. So the show will resume March 3rd, Saturday, 6 p.m. Eastern time, so be sure to tune into that. And like my co-host Jabril said, this has been another cracking open of the STEM Files on Blog Talk Radio. Brother Keeley, thank you again for joining us and gracing us with your presence and your knowledge.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Assalamu alaikum.
Absolutely.
Assalamu alaikum.
And we hope to have Brother Keeley on the show again in the near future. And once again, this has been the STEM Files. Peace, everyone.